This podcast is brought to you by the new term at fxphd.com. Among the new courses on offer this term are new Katana lighting training, a world first with Matt Leonard. Included in that is free VPN access to a full version of Katana, along with many other key programs to help you learn, such as Arnold, Maya, Nuke, Cinema 4D, and just heaps more. All there to help you take your career to the next level. Check it out at fxphd.com. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, the first of a bunch of new podcasts for 2013, but probably with one of the most successful films from a VFX point of view of 2012, Life of Pi. I'm joined by Ty Rubin. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you.
And Matt Wallen, how are you, sir?
Excellent.
So let me start, as I don't normally, with a quote from the visual effects supervisor. Now, I'm often jokingly quoting at the end of these shows something from the film. I'm going to read you something that he said. This is Bill Westerhofer from an interview that we did over at FX Guide. And he said, speaking of a meeting he had with Ang Lee, the film's director, that as Ang Lee left that meeting, this is way back when the film was first being put together, so I think we're talking about August 09, Ang Lee turned to him and said, "I look forward to making art with you." And then reading from the quote, "This was one to me one of the most rewarding things about working on this. It was the first chance to really combine art with VFX. Every shot was an artistic exploration. To make an ocean a character, to make it interesting, we had to strive to make this all as visually stunning as possible." So my question to you, and I'm going to start with you, Ty, is do you think at an artistic level, Art of Pi is really a match of sort of technique and art, or is that overinflating what we're looking at here?
Well, to me, it certainly is. I don't know where different people place that bar. You know, even the word art, in my mind, it's always kind of relative to the particular conversation. And I happen to have always seen American filmmaking as, you know, the new art form. Within the context of that category, you get the range of films that we're witness to. But in my mind, when the director and the storytelling is being realized with a very high level or high value placed on innovation and creativity, whatever, again, creativity is one of those loosey-goosey words, but when that is a driving factor in the decision making, in the storytelling, the visual storytelling, I see it as definitely being an art form. And with the infusion of all the digital technologies, the visual effects technologies that have developed over the last, I would speak more specifically, with digital in the last 20 years, it was very refreshing and rewarding to see those tools and those capacities so joyously, for lack of a better word, inspired, for another word, in the process of creating the film. It kind of, in my mind, it kind of had a surreal quality in the best of that, kind of world, a hyper world, a hyper reality, and it seemed to kind of ring with a visual quality that I just found very compelling and captivating, and in my mind, it did. Bump into new territory often, at least several times for me, which I felt invigorated, creatively refreshed, as it were, to be involved in cinema and involved in being both an audience and a creator at this point in time. It was sort of a nice crossroads for me.
Matt, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with Ty in large measure. I mean, I've always thought of, cinema and indeed visual effects, I think, as it is an art form. I think it certainly can be elevated to a high art form. And, sometimes it's maybe a lesser art form than others in both counts. But I think this movie, for me, both cinematically, its visuals, its narrative structure, the way in which the overarching story is told. I mean, it's a very, you know, if I put on my sort of critic's hat and try to wax, you know, quote worthy, I guess, you know, I mean, it's a really magical film, like in the truest sense of the word. I think it really takes on an aesthetic and a veneer and a an emotional quality, what's the word I was thinking of earlier? It's almost a metaphysical kind of quality too to the narrative and to the visuals and the way in which the story unfolds and the way we experience certain particular moments within the film that harken back to previous stories that are told throughout in the childhood of the main character, as well as through the experience that he has on the boat with the tiger and the other animals. And but yeah, I think that, you know, this film definitely achieves something that very few other films that I've seen this year, if any, really come to do, in that it is truly, you know, a fantasy film, like a real magical journey to some kind of, it sounds so goofy, but to some just kind of other place, some other kind of mental state. And it's just, I was totally enraptured with the visuals and with the story. And I mean, I just totally loved it. I thought it was amazing. It was one of the best films I've seen this year, if not the best film this year.
Yeah, I think we should really jump in at this point in time and be really, and I don't want to make an impassioned plea, I guess. If you haven't seen the film, I mean, that's an odd thing for me to say, I beg you to switch us off, because I think this is such a good film, and we're going to have to bust up a few things. And if you haven't seen it, you've only got one chance to see this film the way the director intended, which is without me telling you what happens. And so don't spoil that. I mean, sometimes you say that, so it doesn't really matter. Just tell me what happens anyway, right? Like, and I've got to tell you, if it's an Avengers film, it probably doesn't, you know, really spoil it that much, because the experience is the reward. But in this case, I'm begging you, without saying any more, if you don't know what happens because you haven't seen it, see it first, because you deserve to have this story play out. And you need to see the film, I think, for the first time in the way the director intended. Otherwise, so much of what you see, you know, sort of is interpreted through that glass of actually knowing what's coming. And also, we need to now discuss it, because there are some points we're going to make about the aesthetics that are going to be related to this aspect of what the plot actually happens, which is how it should be. And I'd hate to spoil it. So one last attempt. If you haven't seen the film, for the crying out loud, take us at our word. Ignore us, switch us off, put on the radio, do anything else. Okay, so that being said, I wanted to discuss this idea of art in the film, because I think it's, as you said, Matt, one of the best films of the year. But it has this property of art, and I'm going to sound like I'm getting a little intellectual. We will, of course, focus on the VFX, but there was a terrific documentary by the BBC on what is beauty, and they, as a particularly good art historian who I love, I've read a lot of his books and I've studied his stuff. I've watched any documentary this guy's in. And anyway, he listed 10 things. He actually said this. So, you know, he actually tries to analyze in art, by long modern art or old traditional forms of right back to Roman days, what is it that makes something beautiful? But I think I'm safe in saying, Ty and Matt, you'd both agree this is a beautiful film, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. No,
it's the critic.
An art historian called Matthew Collins, and he's really good at doing I don't know if it's been aired in the UK, but it was a BBC Two thing called What is Beauty? But he tried to tackle this problem. Like, you know, you would say this film is beautiful. Why would you say it's beautiful? And the reason I'm relating this at the beginning is that, and it will make sense in a second, his 10 list of 10 things actually include things that are particularly relevant to this film, the idea of nature and simplicity, the idea of some kind of transformation, and in fact, stuff to do with surprise and the spontaneity and the selection of what the artist chooses to place in and not place in the film. And so many of these properties are particularly relevant. But where I wanted to come to is the artist, the director, had to make some choices here as to how far to push this film into the realm of it being very artistic, non-realistic, and dreamlike. But we don't know it's a dream. We don't know it's an altered reality until the end of the film. There you go. There's your spoiler. And so in a sense, that was a really interesting artistic and technical exercise, because you could make this film very surreal. You could do it all in cartoon animation and it would be valid from the story point of view. But as a viewer watching it, in one sense, we want it to be completely real, and thus we want the tiger, Richard Parker, to look 100% photoreal. But also there are hints at the nature of it not being a 100% accurate account. We can't lose the audience in that. They can't believe that that's a mistake. And for me, there were quite a few of those. There were quite a few points where I thought almost like that's not realistic. And in this show, I would flag it as being a mistake, but I believe it was an artistic decision. It was something that verged on, I want this to be beautiful at this point. And so, for example, let me give you a really easy example. The meerkat sequence, he finds a tooth in a flower. Now, I would be sitting here going, well, that's just a really stupid plot point. Except for he's retelling a story which didn't happen. It is a mythology, as it were. And in that context, it's completely valid because there are all sorts of symbolisms and underlying things going on about the island. And the fact that the island was maybe a floating island, wasn't actually an island, it was just floating across the Atlantic or Pacific. Again, completely unrealistic. I would scream blue murder, except for in the context of this film where that is all being retold to cover the murder of his mother. It's completely valid. And that's why I wanted to bring this idea up of beauty. How well, Ty, do you think he managed to keep us as an audience believing the story without giving away the twist, but by the same token alluding to this nature of the story as actually being a recollection to cover a tragedy?
Well, I guess that you raise an interesting... you raise a very interesting idea, which is the balancing of this kind of hyperreal or surreal or dreamlike world and then grounding it in some kind of reality that allows for, you know, it to be a human story and not lose its human qualities. Because I think one of the things that the director Ang Lee did was that he kept certain aspects as real as possible to ground the larger kind of dream or surreal narrative. So, for example, the animals are treated as very realistic for the first half of the film. They're established in the real world. And I would say that there's a beauty, the way that the zoo, for example, in the beginning is shot in a very beautiful way. The art direction is gorgeous and
really
the color selection. And it has a certain kind of hyper sense of light and color, which is really great, but it's still very grounded. Things behave real, and bicycles and people walk and talk and so forth. And then as you get into the ship, that reality begins to start to splinter, and even to the point where the father's giving, you know, sleeping pills to the animals, and the environments themselves start to become very hectic and lose their grounding in reality, until finally when there's the big catastrophe on the ship and we transition into the lifeboat, and from the lifeboat forward, it becomes a very a world with loose rules. It becomes this surreal dream kind of world where things are able to do non-real things. You know, the way that the action unfolds is no longer grounded in the reality of the day-to-day world that is established in the beginning. However, all that said, I think that by keeping the tiger extremely realistic and not ever letting it become a cartoon of a tiger. And to me, and this was probably the most unsettling aspect of the film, was the zebra that falls into the lifeboat and breaks a leg, and the horrific crying that it did it seemed like 25 minutes. I'm sure it was, you know, 8 minutes of screen time. But it was haunting, and it was horrifying, and it really made me uncomfortable as an audience viewer, as an audience member. And the way that physical reality of the animals carried into the more surreal and more dreamlike sequences, all the way to the where you referenced, Mike, where the island of meerkats, which themselves are still rendered very beautifully as real animals. It's sort of the the animal world and the physicality of that world and the photorealism of that world that is the transition in my mind. It's the line that connects all the way back to the beach when he's finally back, you know, and lands on dry land, and then the lion, you know, disappears into the jungle. So I think it was a very sophisticated balancing act, but in my mind it was that fulcrum of the very realistic animals that, that didn't fall into parody or cartoon or anything like that, that that actually allowed for that balance to take place.
Now, in our interview with the filmmakers, and we tried to do a really you know, a good job at representing this film, because I think it is landmark in terms of a lot of the visual effects, the only point that they allowed themselves to have what you might call a non-realistic moment with the animals in the lifeboats, certainly the only kind of anthropomorphication of the was the orangutan's look before the orangutan dies to underline the mother's death. Other than that, everything was so based in reality that apparently, and I had the benefit of hearing the director talk about this, if he couldn't show us a reference of the clip of an animal doing it, it didn't make it in the film. So I take nothing away from the animators that were doing the work, because it's spectacularly worked good, but they weren't guessing what a tiger snarl would look like. It would reference an individual video of a tiger snarl. So huge level of realism there. But Matt, at some point, like, there was just too many meerkats. At some point, you were thinking to yourself, it's not quite hinged right. But I'd been carried so far along. I mean, obviously, I'd gone straight to the meerkat island type at that level of mm-hmm. sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I'd have called foul. But I'd been carried there so gently that I was still buying it. It hit me like a ton of bricks when I discovered that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you bring that sequence up in particular, because if I were to have any qualms about this movie, and I think, if you know, that's a very weak if, because I really did love this film, and I think the effects in it are just so amazing. But the Meerkat Island, the floating island sequence in the film, where it's kind of the real first very direct moment where there's some inkling that, you know, the story that we're being told may not actually be what really happened, right? I mean, it's sort of the first real obvious tip of the hat, right? The kind of the supernatural qualities of this island, and you mentioned the tooth. And the meerkats, I thought, were really pretty neat. It was kind of exciting, and I was like, but it was so weird to see them on an island, for one thing. But then, yeah, there was a moment where there were a few too many almost, and I saw the film in stereo, and I think overall the stereo effects, I'm not a big fan of 3D, but I thought it worked great in this film in so many instances. But the island with the meerkats was the one time where it felt like it crossed over into a kind of a less objective kind of reality, and it turned into a much more subjective, it took on a much more subjective tone, and it didn't work quite as well.
Which makes our role that much more difficult, right? Because I can't tell you that was wrong, because I can't believe that they accidentally, having got it so right, got it slightly off kilter.
And that's the thing I was going to say too, is like, you know, on the beauty side of it, like, I mean, I think, you know, I know a few other companies were involved as well, but the work on the primary work on, you know, the Richard Parker and the orangutan, the hyena, the zebra, the work of Rhythm and Hughes in this film, I think is without a doubt, in my book, it is the best work I've ever seen of, you know, mammals on a film. I mean, it blew my mind. I mean, some of it, I can't believe what I was seeing. The animation is just staggering. The rendering is gorgeous. And the emotive quality that is conveyed through the performances of these animated creatures is just, I mean, it is the top work I've seen this year by far. Even the orangutan, I thought, really rivals the really great orangutan that we saw in the Rise of the Death of the Fall of the Planet of the Apes, or whatever.
You know, well, I mean, no, I think I'd,
it really
I did like that.
It gets
that.
Into that arena, you know, of
they're
photorealism.
They're in the same arena. I wouldn't say one is better than the other. They were both spectacularly good. But I do agree with you. I mean, we're recording this before the nominations for the Oscars come out, and I'm willing to happily bet my career that this gets the nomination for an Oscar. And if it doesn't, then I'm willing to come on air and eat anything, my hat, my microphone, whatever it is.
To mention, though, too, just you know, anecdotally, I guess, is just I think it's really interesting to think about Ang Lee as a director, as a filmmaker. Like, if you look back at his career in total, look at his filmography, like, I mean, it's so interesting, like, the divergent kinds of work that he's done as a filmmaker. And really,
Matt, I
with
couldn't
very
agree
few
with
exceptions,
more, yeah.
The amazing success that he's had, you know, I mean, like, he's got such a powerful, strong vision as an artist himself. I mean, you know, I am just really fascinating career.
I tweeted after I walked out of this, you know, Hulk, all is forgiven, because I just thought this was incredible. Hey, the thing that I was going to say, though, about making our work hard, right, and God knows it's a walk in the park compared to what the artists had to do, but I mean, I can sit here quite calmly and discuss how impressive Lola's work was in manipulating the emaciating pie, sorry, at the end, you know, when he's leaving Richard Parker on the beach, or how good the work was with, you know, NPC's Storm. I mean, you can kind of evaluate that, but mm-hmm. Once you get into some of these areas, that stereo area you mentioned and some of the stuff, especially, I mean, another example, which I think is a common thing I heard from people when I was talking about this film, because, you know, it was sort of, we knew about this film a long time before I think even I saw it, and it opened a lot later here in Australia than elsewhere, but I got to see it in early screening. There were people that were saying, oh, this looks like some kind of Fantasia, because they'd seen the sequences with the amazing
shot
reflected
of the whale. Right?
Exactly, yeah. And so it had this, and I was like, no, if you haven't seen the film, you need to not go in there thinking that you're seeing some kind of, you know, dance of animals in a sort of cartoony kind of beauty, because the whale sequence and that reflection of the incredibly orange sky on the still water, mm-hmm. That's where I get into trouble over trying to discuss this from a realism point of view, because I can't judge that. It sits in the context of the beauty of the film. They are extraordinarily beautiful shots. Are they super photo real? Well, who cares, almost, you know? At some point, I was buying the story, so...
Yeah. Well, they walk an interesting line, those kind of shots, too. I think where, you know, there's the one of the sunset and the sky and the clouds and the water. Basically, to describe the shot, it's where the lifeboat is sort of floating in a very still, extremely calm, almost glass-like ocean. And you see the sky reflected... And there's sort of it's a moment of respite between, you know, Richard Parker, the tiger, and Pi, the main character, who's sort of floating on his little, dinghy of floatables in the water. But then there's a similar sequence that sort of is repeated over and over again, and it really exacerbates, I think, metaphorically and visually, one of the other themes throughout the narrative, which is sort of this sense of aloneness, of isolation, of a kind of communication and a kind of connection between two different species. And, you know, what does this mean? And what does it mean about the journey and about, you know, the struggle to survive? And I mean, there's all these amazing metaphors, but there's another sequence that's very similar where the boat is seen floating in a very still glass-like point at night. And it ties back into a part of the narrative that's told earlier where you see the boat floating really on a reflection of itself, you know, in a reflection of a star field in the sky. And there's some play with sort of the animation. And you kind of at that point in the film, you kind of go with it because the stars kind of move in a way that is sort of not natural. And there's this other kind of supernatural kind of thing that happens in terms of the visuals. But you're ready to go there at that point because you've sort of been taken on this journey and you're kind of you feel as a viewer, not in a painful way, but in a way that's kind of it draws out your empathy, where you kind of feel as exhausted as the character and as the tiger feel at that point, where they've been struggling to survive in these very arduous conditions, while at the same time struggling to reach some kind of an understanding with one another, where they can sort of they need each other to survive, you know, kind of thing. And I think some of those visual moments in the film are just, they're so well executed and they're so powerful, even though they do cross over into the realm of, I think, as you said earlier, Ty, too, the kind of the surreal.
Ty, let me sidestep my problem for a second by going to the other end and start your, I mean, if I can direct you towards the sequence that I think Booth did of the Tiger Vision sequence. So Richard Park appears down underwater kind of thing, and there's this kind of squid stylistic kind of move through plankton and stuff. It's the only sequence like that in the film. It's quite a departure from everything else around it. Did it stand out for you? Because a lot of people have seen the film and kind of forgotten that sequence even happened.
Yeah, it didn't stand out for me, and maybe that's because I think what I'm hearing, and just to make a point on my perspective, is, you know, when he finally gets to the Meerkat Island and he finds the tooth, all that was for me was an affirmation of my worst fear, which is that, you know, that this is some kind of delusion. I didn't never really believe that it was the truth. I didn't believe that,
no point.
You know, that he was. No, I think that once he found his way onto the boat, you know, with the flying fish and the fact that he didn't get eaten, and the, you know, and then the dolphins in giant groups and the shots Matt just mentioned with the star fields and stuff, I kind of felt like I had left Kansas, as they say. You know, I mean, I was completely seeing the hallucinations of a boy who is grappling with mortality and grappling with religion, because it's very established in my mind in the beginning that he has metaphysical concerns. And so I was not, as a viewer, for me, thinking that I was seeing reality once the ship went under. And to me, the movie begins to become a dream or a surrealist, surrealist piece once the ship sinks. So the tooth to me in that scene on the Meerkat Island was really just an affirmation that I wasn't going to get to just dream my way to the end of the movie, that something more was coming that had to do with this death and you know, a the frailty of humanity. And even the island is a silhouette of a floating man, you know. As far as just that shot, not to lose track of that question, you know, I thought it was interesting because I was a big Hitchcock fan, as we all are, and, you know, he Lifeboat, you know, everything happens in a boat. I thought there was a little bit of an attempt, a smart attempt on the director's part to bring new material into the mix, and I think some of that stuff, maybe it had a specific function in his mind, but I also thought it was a way to infuse new material, new opportunity into the larger film. So that's hope that's kind of the answer.
I must admit, I think that I didn't think it was all. I thought it was stylized because I thought it was super clever. And this is probably in the book, but I'm going to give Ang Lee credit for it anyway. It's super clever to bring up spirituality, religion, an openness to accepting religion in such a near comical and endearing way back in reality of India. So that by the time we hit this back section, I was thinking not so much this is all a dream, but this is a guy who's just so going to be interpreting what he's around him. He's a kid. He's interpreting it with that kind of a, you know, we've established that he's not a gritty, hard-nosed kind of guy. And so it was just his take on this world, looking back through the eyes of someone who was now in their sort of middle to late part of their life. And so I didn't see it as being all a dream, but I just saw it as being sort of like a caricature of what actually happened. But I didn't think that none of it actually happened, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, by the time we hit the Meerkat, I was like, okay, now, what the hell's going on here? Because please don't tell me this is all a dream sequence. But I don't think it was. I never felt cheated. I mean, I do often feel cheated in the, you know, it's a dream sequence kind of reveal, because I felt like I'd invested a lot. I did not feel ripped off at the end of this film.
Well, that's because, and I think that's part of, we probably should look at it because we are talking about the film in totality. We're not giving anything away. The genius of the story in my mind is that you know, whether you're interested in religion or you're interested in the human narrative, okay, the story of man, the story of a person's life, where do we ultimately find value? It's not in what we own. It's not in what we've, you know, been able to buy. It's in the story that our life represents, the narrative of our existence, the grand narrative. And you could almost replace religion in this film to narrative. And what it is that the reason that it ultimately is satisfying in my mind is that little brief moment of dialogue where the Pi as an adult says, you know, which story do you like? And of course, everyone likes, you're the guy, you're the writer. By the time you get to that moment, you're going to say, I like the story of the tiger better. And then he says, so as with God. You know, what that means, I don't know. But it's a beautiful bookend for it to not function as the dream that you're hinting towards, Mike, which is, oh, no, this is all a dream? Well, that blows. You know, that's one of those fix the problem by waking up the characters kind of a deal. It doesn't work poorly in The Wizard of Oz because you know that Dorothy has been transformed. And it's similarly, this is a transformative movie, and I don't think it leaves you feeling slighted or cheated because the journey was so great. You know, the narrative was so great that you still go, I love that narrative. I love that part where the whale came. And, you know, you were invested, like you said. So the transition out is the little Meerkat Island.
I can't just believe that you blew the plot line of Wizard of Oz for everyone that was listening.
Oh, my God.
That's
a great point, though, Ty. Like, I mean, that's one of those things, too, that, like, you know, for me, like, you know, just on a personal level, my wife had read the book, and her and I went and saw this movie together, and we saw it in 3D at the super fancy new theater they built here in our town that was great projection, great experience seeing it. And by the end of the movie, like, we walked out, and I was like, God, I love that movie. That was so great. You know, she was like, yeah, that was really amazing. And she said it was just like the book. I mean, it was really so close to the book. She had just read it before, finished reading it before we'd gone to see the film. And so she really liked it, which is sort of interesting from, you know, a piece that originated in a different media, right? But I walked out of the theater, and I was sort of like, you know, I kind of have just – you know, I won't go into it, but just for own personal reasons, my own background, I kind of have a lot of problems with religion and religious messages. And so I walked out of the theater thinking, like, and part of me, and I was going to ask you guys this, although it makes me sound kind of dumb, I feel like, in a way, like the message at the end of the movie, that kind of, and so it is with God, where he talks about that. And he talks specifically about God, and as a child, he's sort of interested in all these different religions and exploring all the different facets of all these religions. And I like the way you explained it, Ty, only because, you know, for me, that's sort of a complex issue to grapple with. And it was something that I wasn't sure if I understood that, like, was he saying that on some level in the end, I sort of felt like he was almost saying that, you know, the story of God, like, we believe it regardless of its absurdity or superficiality. I mean, there was a part of me that was almost like, well, wait a minute, that's a terrible reason to believe in that, isn't it? Because it's a better story. I don't know. It was interesting. It was a weird, and I was going to ask you guys what you thought of that, like if what your interpretation of that was. Because
I thought it was faith affirming, not faith denial. Because
no, I did too. But I also thought it was faith affirming, but not on the basis of anything other than, it's nice to believe in something that sounds better than, like, it was, you know what I'm saying? A little bit, maybe, or,
well, but let me just put this.
It felt like a weak argument.
Well,
maybe, I don't know.
But okay, so let me put this to you just as a point, and we'll move off it because obviously we don't want this to the religious show.
It's a little
show,
too philosophical.
But clearly, if you happen to be inclined to believe in God, and certainly I am in that category, it's this whole idea that you know, you can pick at the specific points of a religious story and say it's very unlikely this character suddenly generated this many loaves of bread mathematically from this many, you know, and the amount of wine, and why was it wine, and surely that transformation is an odd one. That isn't the point of it. The point of it isn't you to pick holes in whether, you know, he begat her before he begat him. And people that can get too literal with religion cause wars. So for me, it was a faith-affirming thing, which was that the sentiment of what it was what would be important to a God, not the details of whether or not you're going to say this or that individual thing. So I don't want to get into a whole religious thing, but I didn't. I mean, I found it, as I just said, very positive. But by the same token, the story had set that up, right? That wasn't coming out of nowhere. This was like, we'll tell you that story, and at the end of it, you will believe in God, was a central part of the sort of the hook that gets the writer to sit down in the first place.
Yeah.
Hey, so let's just discuss it in terms of technical accomplishments. It is a magnificent piece of filmmaking from a technical point of view for just a bunch of reasons. I'm just going to start with one obvious one, which is that you've got a bunch of visual effects that have to take place in a boat, in a tank, in stereo, and be on the ocean with CG characters with great tracking, great lighting matches. And there's no point trying to do an HDR because all you're going to get is all the blue screen. You know, you have to have keying that works, tracking that works, character animation that works. You have to do set extensions. You have to have good fluids, good interaction with characters. You know, you needed to have subsurface scattering on the fur and then have it interact with the fluids. I mean, there are films that have tanked because they just haven't been able to cope with having their characters out at sea. And this had, what, 3/5 of the film at sea? So, Ty, this is, I mean, a horrible job on paper to be burdened with.
Yeah, I mean, I had to go back when I got, I didn't really prep to see the movie. You know, I hadn't investigated it too fully. I just thought, I want to see it. Let's check it out. And I literally had to come back and like kind of scour through the internet to just try to see what was real and what wasn't real. And, you know, like, I think a lot of people's main reaction will be that they were seeing a lot of a real tiger, you know, like they must use a trained tiger for part of the movie. And my understanding is that every shot of that tiger in a boat is synthetic. There's no shot where they actually put a tiger in a boat. Well, you know, the complexities of even looking at the shot breakdowns and what they were shooting on in plates and what they were shooting, it boggles me. They've taken each problem and addressed it in such a seamless and sophisticated way that the totality of what you experience, regardless of whether or not they're presenting true photorealism or true hyperrealism, is so total and complete that your eye never gets distracted. I think that's another reason why the storytelling is so potent, is that you never get those itchy feelings where you're like, whoa, that's not working. There's something wrong, or I saw a flash, or there's a line there that doesn't belong there. It really did a great job of softening and massaging all the tells, you know what I mean, that normally alert you to synthetics.
Yeah, and another thing about that I thought that was just totally interesting, if you go back and you look at the movie just on an editorial, from an editorial perspective, like, it's really interesting. I think in the entire movie, there's so many really long, long shots, which has obviously a huge impact on the way in which the visual effects are produced and accomplished, and sort of how forgiving they might be too. I mean, you really have to be very exact in some of these really long shots because, you know, you have so much time to look at, especially, you know, thinking on from the point of view of, you know, compositing, let's say, like just matching, you know, with whatever was in the tank, with the background, with the sky replacement, with, you know, the digital water in the distance or whatever elements are in the foreground. I think they said there's something only like about just under 1,000 shots in the entire movie. And I think they were saying that about almost 700 shots, I think, in the that are visual effect shots. So if there's only just under 1,000 shots in the whole movie, and some 700 of those or so are visual effect shots, I mean, you're looking at like a huge number of shots, just given the running time of the film, that are over at least 2,000 frames plus in length. I mean, and that's a huge amount of work. I mean, that is just crazy, especially when you think about the fact that it's also being done for this film in stereo, you know? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Matt, I thought the stereo was spectacularly good, and it had a lot of stuff in it. My initial reaction was the stereo was so good, there couldn't have been much stereo going on, because I, like you, am not necessarily the greatest fan of 3D. I don't hate it, but I do find it can get in the way. But
well,
then,
it was great in this film, though. It was amazing. If I might, real quick, I wanted to ask you one thing about one shot, one sequence in the movie, and I'm curious if you noticed this, and I don't know if I heard this story, and I don't know if it's true, but there's a sequence in the film where they're in the boat, and both the tiger, Richard Parker, and Pi, the main character, they're really getting hungry, and they're not sure what they're going to do for food, and I don't know if this is after the whale has crashed on the boat and wrecked some of their supplies that he sort of took out of the boat and put on the raft or what, but all these flying fish come into a scene in the film, and it's a really just an amazing moment. And I heard a story, I don't know if this is true, but I heard it before I saw the film, so I kind of think it's true, but I didn't see this happen in the theater. But I heard that they actually switched in a really clever way. They changed the aspect ratio of the shots that were being projected in order to create a greater degree of three-dimensionality, or the appearance of a greater degree of 3D in the sequence with the flying fish, where they actually shrunk the frame of the main part of the picture that was being projected. So there was like, you know, there was like a larger black border on the edges of the frame, but then the fish, you know, came further out across the black, which gave you a sense of a greater depth. And I don't know if that's real or if that's just a story that somebody made up. Because when I watched the film, I saw that particular sequence, and I was looking at the edges of the frame, like, oh, are they going to, like, in a cut, is it going to jump in? And like, you won't notice it, right? Because the way that it's a creative cut. And I don't know if that's something that actually happened or not, or if you would know anything about.
You know, I can't answer that. Claudio Miranda, the DP, was actually interviewed on the American Cinematographer podcast, and he discussed this very point, which was the idea that they would change the aspect ratio. So initially they were planning on doing it more. Aang was really keen on playing with the aspect ratio because it has been done in some other films, and in particular it had been done with the stereo, IMAX versions of the Dark Knight stuff. But they did do it at that point, so the black comes down more into the picture, thus allowing the flying fish to actually break the frame and go over the black. So if you were to freeze it on a frame at the cinema, you'd see a flying fish over a black border, which we might think of as a letterbox. The only thing I'm going to say there is that I think that that's been focused on mainly as they were trying to change the aspect ratio of the film in a sense that you would suddenly jump. And certainly there was some discussion about doing this from a much more sort of 4:3 to a much more 2:3, 5:1 kind of thing. But what actually I perceived as happening was they were using a floating window for stereo. And so I'm not having a go at Claudio, but I think that it may be these two concepts have been a little intermixed in the PR. I could be wrong, and I'd love it if anyone knows and they can email me, especially from Rhythm and Hughes. But it's not uncommon in stereo to float a black window so that you are, in fact, putting a top and bottom border on your stereo so that you can fake out where the screen edge is, thus allowing the stereo effect to be amplified by basically cheating the frame of the edge of the projected scene into the room.
If that were true, that would make more sense to me, only in that, like, I was conscious of the potential of that, and I was so curious to see what that would look like, but I never noticed an actual change in the aspect ratio of what was being projected. So that would make a lot more sense to me. But I thought that was a great – it worked to great effect. I mean, it was definitely a really neat moment in the film. And I think with regards to the stereo in particular, I really found that to be quite effective.
Everyone goes to great lengths these days to say, oh, we didn't use any tricks in terms of the stereo. There was no point where, you know, there was swords being waved at the audience, blah, blah, blah. And I would say on the whole, if I was talking to someone that wasn't, you know, like you guys in the industry, I'd say that was the case with this film. But in reality, that's not the case at all. There's a point where the tiger jumps out. I mean, it's a complete shock moment. It's the first time we see, I think, Richard Parker in the life raft, and he just jumps straight out. And I swear my wife ended up with her feet like, I mean, I think she sort of almost flipped in the chair. I think she was nearly, because she jumped so high, and it was just completely a visual gag. But having said that, it was only one of maybe a few, the flying fish being another, that did do that. And so I totally think that's valid, right? I mean, you're using a cinematic technique to get a reaction.
Yeah, well, and thematically too, like, you know, that first reveal of Richard Parker, you know, it kind of should be a moment that is incredibly interesting and frightening. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of appropriate, I think.
Yeah, totally.
It's not abuse of the, you know, the use of 3D in that capacity. It felt like it was a smart choice.
There was another film, Journey to the Center of the Earth, where a character picks up a yo-yo for no apparent reason and just chooses to spin it while talking to another character. And no yo-yo has ever appeared at any other point in the film. And the only reason for doing this was to have the yo-yo come out at me, I'm sure. And this is the exact thing that we would have hated to see. So that wasn't in anything like that. It's completely motivated. But that being said, he didn't stop short of using 3D to get the audience to jump. And as my wife really ripped my arm off as she did it, I can testify it had a lot of great effect. It was really, really good. It was shot in 3D on the Fusion 3D rigs from Cameron Pace. And the reason they went with the Cameron Pace rigs was that they had a lot of experience with underwater work because of Jim Cameron. And so if you're going to have a stereo rig dealing with a water-based environment for two-thirds of the shot or whatever it was, three-fifths of the show, it made a lot of sense to go with a company that was comfortable with working with water. And they went with the Arri Alexas because the DOP just tested them and he thought that they looked the nicest and the most cinematic and just basically went with the look of them. Of course, Epix would have been another consideration given their small package, and that was certainly the way that other stereo films have gone in this kind of current blockbuster season. But this was an Arri Alexa shoot. Now, from that point of view, I thought the footage, I got to see it at this director screening, so it was a very calibrated screen. They literally said they'd spent had experts in for most of the afternoon calibrating the screen and the throw, so it was perfect. But it was breathtakingly good-looking 3D from my point of view, and the image quality was really good. Ty, you didn't see it in 3D, but was the image quality good?
It was, and in fact, I saw it at just one of the local multiplexes, and I was quite very happy. But you know, oftentimes now the theaters, the new generation of multiplexes, they must really have an emphasis on the image quality, because I just thought it was a great image, and I was sitting on a great, you know, a strong rake seat, and just thought it looked awesome.
Let's talk about the water now. It was a character in its own right. They had this big tank that they were using, and cleverly had built at one end of it a complete wave suppression unit, because as many other films have suffered from in the past, and they solved, you have waves reflecting back from the edges of the tanks, which mean you get a very unrealistic wave property in the tank. And as they had this big wave suppression, which is a series of giant kind of, imagine 3D X's that are just concrete giant, well, the sort of thing that you had on the beach at Saving Private Ryan to stop them coming ashore, stacked in one end of the pool, it just took out all the energy from the waves, which meant they didn't reflect back. That being said, most of the waves were removed. Now, from our research, they went out on a research trip, I think, off Thailand, and were clocking the wave swells in a storm at about 14 seconds as a period for the loop of a swell, and doing about 6 to 7 feet. And that's what they were aiming at, that they could only get about a 4-foot swell on a 12-second cycle. But a 12-second cycle to a 14 is pretty close. And then that additional amount of swell came from amping up as much as replacing all of the water in some shots, and obviously extending it out in others. And I think that water integration, which was using the Houdini pipeline that Aaron Rhythm and Hughes have, was really, really good. It was a very different company that did the water for the storm, but just taking to the lifeboat second, which was Rhythm and Hughes, who were also, of course, doing the characters, as we said, the water solved really, really well. And the stereo of having the cameras out there in stereo meant that what I was looking at, which was nearly always the boat, just resolved really, really well. Matt, for you?
The one sequence in the film with the whale breaching out of the water is the one sequence with the water aspect, anyway, that I had the one sort of a problem with just visually. And I think it was interesting what you were saying before, Mike, too, about people who saw the trailer for it, saw that sequence and said, oh, it looks like some Fantasia water world kind of animal kind of thing. And I think it's the one sequence that goes beyond what we saw sort of in the rest of the film. It goes sort of more, it's more like the Meerkat Island sequence. It's a little bit more surreal and more fantasy maybe visually than the other sequences in the film. And I think it's still great work. I mean, you know, my wife, who read the book and saw the movie with me, she loved that sequence. She didn't have any problem with it. But I think for me, maybe just in a really subjective way, something about that the look of it, the aesthetic of it. While it was still beautiful, it took me out of the moment in a way because I was so conscious of it being a visual effect somehow in a way that was different.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I don't know we've yet seen someone do that phosphorescence well on screen. And it may be a problem with just getting that look on a projected screen. That
yeah. It's,
but that being said, I agree with you. Also, I think I said earlier, you know, if it didn't look 100% real, who cared at that point?
Right.
But I'd like to tell you a funny, or funny, an interesting anecdote. Now, I was driving when I heard this, so I couldn't make any notes, but I'm just going from memory. Apparently, the DOP and Ang Lee went out in a boat for reference to a bay that has this phosphorescence algae in it. And this was like way before the film started. And they literally went swimming. And so there was this moment where the DOP and the director are like lying on their backs getting this at night in this water, sort of mucking around. And the story was being told by the DOP. And as you can imagine, he was just recounting what an amazing experience that was, just sort of really that, you know, his job involved lying around with directors in the water.
In the glowing pool.
Yeah, exactly. it's extraordinary. I did want to also just, if I could, circle back on your point about the stormwater. I said it was being done differently. Just for the, I know a lot of people are listening are very technical, so I just wanted to flag a couple of things. That water, the second, all right, it was first in the film, the sequence where the boat is going down was done by MPC, as I said, but it was using Scanline's water stuff. In fact, a new water surface simulator method that they'd helped develop at MPC. And some of you would know that Scanline's water sim stuff is called Flowline. So that was what MPC was using, and their waves were considerably different. So I quoted some numbers before, so I have the numbers on this. It's they were up to sort of 45 feet high, 820 feet long, and you're right, they had a lot of spray. There was 12 minutes of that, and that was about 100 shots, which underlines your point about how long some of those shots were. But I also want to flag one other thing, which I think is really interesting from a technical point of view. The water that was done by Rhythm and Hughes, in other words, the stuff that was around the boat, the lifeboat, I said that was done in Houdini. What I didn't mention before was it was rendered in Mantra, which is Houdini's renderer. And I think that's something worth noting because the creature work was done using their Voodoo toolset and their proprietary renderer called Ren, I think it is. But anyway, Mantra doesn't get enough credit, and it's really normally the case. It's so close to RenderMan that a lot of people that would be using a Houdini pipeline would probably end up in a RenderMan. It's a very similar kind of renderer. But no, it was done in Mantra, and you know, hats off to the guys at Side Effects Software that it's producing such photorealistic work. It's not just that the sims work or that the special effects type work, which Houdini gets most credit for, but the actual Mantra renderer was producing such beautiful imagery, and I thought that was really, really nice stuff. And, of course, because they had their characters, their pipeline with Voodoo integrating with their stuff, they could, you know, get such great interaction between the two when the like Richard Parker was wet, for example.
Yeah, you know, that brings up an interesting point. I wanted to ask if you knew this, Mike, or maybe Ty, you might know this too. Like, one of the most impressive – I know they said that there was some about – I think they say 14% of the shots that wind up in the film, which is, you know, a significant minority of the shots are of an actual tiger. But one of the shots or a sequence anyway that I found really pretty powerful and compelling were shots of – Richard Parker when he's outside of the boat and he's swimming in the water, and there are shots of just his face breaking the surface of the water with the ears are kind of back and he's wet. And I was curious if you knew if those were part of the 14% or the other, 86%?
As I believe, as I understand, the Richard Parker half submerged was in fact done digitally. And there were some cutaways and other shots of the tiger that were able to be done because there were no need for the actor to be in shot. And that's what made up that 14% and not the stuff where you saw him interacting with the water. And again,
because that stuff was just, I mean, if that's the case, I mean, that stuff was just so amazing to me. And the emotive performance of the facial expression on the Richard Parker character was so powerful. I mean, anybody who's got a, you know, a dog or a cat or whatever, you know, and you spend any time with your animal, you know, giving them a bath or something like that, that look, that expression, I mean, it was just, I mean, it was amazing. It was so well executed. And I don't know, looking at that, I just couldn't, it was one of those moments where I just, you know, where you're sort of looking at something and you know that what you're looking at may not be real. You're looking at something that is a synthetically generated image, and it blew me away. It was so well done.
Yeah, yeah. Was there, I don't want to take anything away from the shots of the tiger, but obviously spectacular. But there was a significant amount of stuff that I thought was interesting back before they left India, and there was, you know, obviously work to make that look period. And I thought I think Ty, you touched on it, the zoo at the beginning, those opening shots, mm-hmm. were just so nicely designed. It was great cinematography as well as just great art direction, but of course a lot of digital animals, so great visual effects. Was there anything else pre-getting on the boat, which tends to sort of swamp all other discussions, that we thought was really standout?
Well, I mean, you can go to the whole list. I mean, the casting was awesome. You know, kids oftentimes are real, can be difficult. They can emote the wrong direction. You know, they can do some kid thing and kind of throw you off. But I thought, and again, I don't know the culture of India with any depth, but it had a certain authentic quality about the people, the scenes, the beats were all seemed accurate to the time frame. The interactions authentic. The acting, just the acting overall, when it was in the film, was just very solid and understated. I thought the guy who played the Pi as the mature adult was very interesting to look at. He had a manner that was very suited for his role. I thought the same was true of the reporter. It was really just constructed brilliantly, I think.
Ty, do you know any of the backstory on the casting? Are you just guessing that? Because that was an extraordinary story on the casting.
The only thing I had heard was that Tobey Maguire, I think, had been cast as the reporter and was changed later on because of concern that he was too recognizable. I haven't read a lot about the casting, but I know that little story.
Well, that's true, but he wasn't just cast. They shot the entire sequence with the reporter. Mm. And the actor who was playing the older Pi gets this phone call from Ang Lee, who says, "I'd like to reshoot a couple of things." And he says, "Well, what?" And he goes, "Well, all of it, actually." And apparently, because I heard that actor interviewed, and he said the reason that was given, though, well, actually, I think he made a point of saying that he was never given a reason, but he thinks the reason was that it was very important from a plot point of view that the audience think that the reporter was unsuccessful. He was not someone that had a reputation, and you saw Tobey Maguire and you couldn't see him as a failed writer or as somebody that didn't have a story, that was a nobody. He was such a somebody that he kind of gave the wrong sort of weight. Whoa. It's almost like he was sort of too well known,
Peter Parker.
Yeah, but more to the point, the audience wouldn't just buy him as somebody that had no success. But the other thing I said that was extraordinary is that 3,000 people were auditioned for the young Pi, which mm-hmm. I think is extraordinary kind of process to find your relatively unknown 17-year-old newcomer to take that role.
Well, and wasn't it the story too that the 17-year-old whose name I don't know, I should know that, but he, the young man who was cast in the role of Pi, he had gone to the audition, I think, with his cousin or his brother or yep. friend or something, and he hadn't even intended to audition. You know, he was just like tagging along, which I thought was so fascinating. And the first thing it made me think of is just that, you know, there's something to be said for kind of going to something like that really completely unprepared, not even really thinking you're going to do it. You don't have all the preconceptions, the nerves, the jitters, you know, and then he winds up sort of, you know, trying out for the part and, you know, over, I'm sure, a number of auditions after that, but winds up getting the role. So I thought that was kind of a neat story too, sort of the serendipitous nature by which, you know, he came to be cast in the role and then just delivered such an amazing performance throughout.
Yeah, and we should say his name because the only reason we don't is we can't say it properly, but I'm going to say it anyway because he so deserves it. And if he was a Hollywood star, we'd never not refer to him by his name. So it's Suraj, S-U-S-U-R-A-J, Sharma, S-H-A-R-M-A. And yeah, he was standout. I actually felt like there must have been a cut of this film that had the flashback at the end actually played out, not described, because I can't imagine why you get Depardieu to play such a relatively minor role as the chef.
Yeah, you know, I had the same thought because you just were kind of waiting for him to show back up.
I mean, this is an actor of immense talent. Been in the news a lot lately for changing his nationality, but I mean, Depardieu is just, God, just a spectacularly good actor. I mean, really can act. And the other one I thought was a standout piece of casting was the father. He had a really believable role that was neither sort of cliched nor necessarily predictable, although he behaved as consistently as a character, but, you know, he wasn't sort of one-dimensional. And now, anyone know what the father's name was? I think it's like Hassan. I think, yeah, Pi's father. But anyway, he was really good. But I actually was referring to visual effects when I asked that question about stuff that was done earlier, like any of the stuff to make it look like a period piece. I think some of the period drama stuff was done by, I'm going to say, Crazy Horse, because there was some matte paintings and stuff. You know, shots where there'd be mountains behind and they didn't think it was sort of dramatic enough when they were at the tea plantation, so they would just completely redo the skyline and stuff. And all of that seemed to be very well integrated in what was going on. And I think another shout-out to this international nature of the film, it's very important to acknowledge that while we've been talking about Rhythm and Hughes, it was a combined Rhythm and Hughes team from Mumbai, Hasselblad, Kuala Lumpur, Vancouver, Taiwan. And I actually saw a presentation that was made at an Autodesk 3D event, and they actually showed how international that was. So when we say that, you know, you might have had someone in Malaysia or India, it wasn't that they gave a shot to the Mumbai team and said, okay, you do that, and then another shot to the Vancouver team. In a single shot, which had water, characters, compositing, skies, you might have had one country on the sky, one on the water, one on the character, one on the comp. The shot was just bouncing around the world. Most of it, I think, was rendered in Taiwan on their cave cloud structure. So very significant role that Rhythm and Hughes has played over the last, what, 10 years, Matt, do you reckon, or maybe it's 20 years in building up this international...
Yeah, and I think, you know, this production, and given the international sort of nature of the way in which this was done, and then what was the other film we were talking about recently, all the work that... was it Atomic Fiction had done, where they rendered a bunch of stuff in the cloud too? And I think we're really seeing some really exciting and interesting changes in the way in which films like this, really, you know, big films with like a large number of shots with incredibly complex work, and the way in which they're being done in a really sort of global, international way with, you know, so many great artists coming to the fore and, you know, bubbling up to the surface really all around the world. And you know, a film like this that is just so technically complex and then achieving this level of work that I really do think is, you know, totally Oscar worthy as, you know, just stellar visual effects work. You know, seeing a production done in this way, it's exciting. It's definitely a big shift.
I mean, Bill Westenhofer, I think, is based in the, you know, California office of Rhythm and Hughes. And so I'm going to say this next thing, try not to insult the California office of Rhythm and Hughes, who are really nice guys. I've been there. Great pet policy and having dogs and stuff in the office. So I love Rhythm and Hughes. But I just think anyone who has some kind of, and I'm going to use the word almost racist kind of bias, that the best visual work has to come out of a North American facility. I mean, I just want to really underline this. As much as I love all my friends that are Californian artists, you know, the work being done out of India, Malaysia, Canada, Taiwan on this film is without a doubt on the same par as the best work being done out of California. There's no reason why it shouldn't be, but we just want to make sure those artists get kind of their fair share of the global kind of praise, because this really wasn't that they were doing roto. This really wasn't that they were doing, you know, fixing up stereo. This was hardcore work.
Yeah, I think some of the I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I think some of the conversation that takes place in just sort of in our community about, you know, subsidies and jobs and, you know, the concerns that people have about, you know, being able to sustain be sustainfully or gainfully employed, you know, without moving vagabond style all around the world. I think those are certainly legitimate and important concerns.
Absolutely.
But I also think that it really should go without saying, and I think you said it really well, just that, you know, regardless of where an artist comes from or where they live or where they work, you know, it by no means should the work coming out of a facility in, say, Mumbai be any different or any less in quality than the work done, you know, at a top-notch, you know, long-standing facility in Los Angeles or something. I mean, there's no reason why that can't be the case, you know. I mean, I think there are incredibly gifted and talented and highly skilled and intelligent artists, you know, all over the world. And, you know, those two conversations and those two issues, I think, are largely separate.
So I don't think there's a lot of point in discussing who should win the Oscar, because I think winning the Oscar is much more defined by the marketing around the film. But who should be nominated is a valid point, and as this goes to where that list has probably been published. But I would say, I think I said it earlier, Ty, this film has to be nominated, because this is definitely would be in the top five. And certainly I imagine all the peers that would have seen this, say, at the Bake Off, would have to recognize this for the quality of work they're seeing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think from all the discussion tonight has been interesting because of the range, you know, of what this film did right, you know, and the range of thinking that went into it, and the you know, the creativity that wasn't necessarily taking too many pieces from the past. It was kind of a forward-looking film in my mind. It was, you know, it was definitely had a kind of flamboyance that was fresh, you know, to my eye, and that it did it brilliantly. So I think it's definitely should make the list, and I wouldn't be surprised if it ended up winning. But like you said, I think being in that top tier, it goes without saying it should be there.
Matt?
Oh yeah, I mean, I would totally agree, and yeah, I think you know, winning whatever that means. I don't know. I mean, it's an honor to be nominated. You know, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, it's who knows why certain things win over others. I mean, I think, you know, we could Todd might know with his Predictinator, Mr.
Yes.
Baziri, but he might have some insight into statistically why something might win over another. Which I'd be curious to hear what Todd has to say on the Oscar preview show if we do one of those this year.
But, well, we are hoping to do exactly that, sir.
Yeah, that's got to be something that's in the hopper. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you look at this film, and I mean, I've gone to see as many of the effects films from this year as I could, including The Hobbit, which you guys just did a show on, and I'm glad I wasn't on it, and I totally disagreed with everything you said. But yeah, I mean, I think this is, for my money, this is the best effects film I've seen this year, bar none. I mean, there's been plenty of other great work this year as well. You know, Prometheus, Dark Knight Rises, et cetera, et cetera. But this one really just took the cake for me on a number of levels. And I think really on the level of what I think we started off talking about at the beginning of the show, in terms of really the art of cinema and the art of the visual effects, and really a co-mingling of those two things, like bringing them together in a really powerful way to tell a story, to tell a really beautiful and poignant story in a really powerful way. And I think that's when visual effects can serve the story in such a strong capacity, and in such a unique way under the vision of a director of this quality, then I think, you know, you're really, it's the best of the best. It's where everything kind of comes together in a way that is just so satisfying for for the viewer, but certainly for, you know, someone who loves visual effects work. I mean, I think, so for me, yeah, this one really sits at the top of my list for this year.
See, now I'm just really wishing that Brokeback Mountain had needed major effect sequences. Hey, I just want to thank you guys for being on the show. I want to thank Todd Sholden, our producer of the VFX show, Matt, who's doing the editing, and Ian, who does a lot of the organizing and stuff. I want to thank both of you for being on the show this week. It's been a great discussion. Ty, is there anywhere that people can connect with you?
Yes, my website is alieninsect.com. There's a little, you know, mail me button, or they can look for me on Facebook. Just look for Ty Rubin.
And Matt, sir?
Yeah, you can find me at my website, which I recently sort of revamped ever so slightly, mattwallen.com, or on the Twitter at Matt Wallen.
I'm, of course, over at FX Guide and at FX PhD, where we have a brand new term that's recently started. And we've got some really great stuff there. And just today we announced that Katana has been included as part of the VPN. So that means that if you are... Yeah, I don't know if you guys understand how this works, but if you are doing training at FX PhD and you are just keen somehow to learn a program you don't already have, in other words, you know, if you've got Nuke and you want to learn more about it, that's great. But for some people, they want to learn about stuff that they don't have. Part of the program at FX PhD provides you with copies of that software that you can use through the VPN. And Katana, being a lighting, innovative lighting tool, has just been added to Arnold, Meyer, Houdini, Softimage, Mudbox, Nuke. I think there's about, I mean, well, the Cinema 4D, BFM, Mocha, Mari, V-Ray, there's something like $50,000 worth of free software that you can use to develop up professional stuff all over at FX PhD. I want to thank you guys so much for being with us. I really enjoyed the show, as I always do with you guys. And thank you so much for listening and joining us in here in the new year. I hope you traveled safe over the holidays. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.